Hi, this is Tony Coomer, and welcome to the Set It Southern Podcast.
Baby, don't give up, 'cause we're the kinds of folks who will always live right around the corner from something big.
Oh, yeah, thank you for downloading Set It Southern Podcast number 3. Today we have the conclusion of our interview with Derek Webb. This interview was recorded August 8th, 2008 in Nashville, Tennessee. Derek was very gracious and very humble and spent about 2 hours with us. And you can learn more about Derek at his website, derekwebb.com, or his fan website, derekwebb.net. And now the conclusion of our interview with Derek Webb. One of the kind of the questions that I have and some other guys we talked about preparing for this interview, it seems like in your music, since you've been on your own, starting with She Must and Shall Go Free, and now up to
Ringing Bell.
It was out there.
It's the new one.
Yeah, I've listened to it a lot. I just can't remember what to call it. So there's been transitions. I mean, obviously there's been a kind of a transition in focus where in the first album, really felt like you were talking a lot of theology, you were talking about the church, you were talking about it in ways that were relational and all these kind of great ways you were talking about this theology. And now there's been a shift in focus, and with the last, with Mockingbird and a little bit with Ringing Bell, there's more of a emphasis on social justice, kind of gospel implication stuff. I think you've talked about it in that way. So what's going on with all that? what are you doing, Derek?
Well, I think probably the easiest way to answer it would be to kind of try to map out a little bit of a timeline. I mean, when I came out of Cademan's, you know, we did 40 Acres and we did Long Line of Leavers, and I didn't write anything beyond Long Line of Leavers. I wasn't writing songs for the band beyond that.
Okay.
For whatever reason, that's just kind of how it worked out. And you know, my role in Cademan's, I mean, the writing was more theological. I mean, 40 Acres was a very theological record for me, and that was a point in my story and in our kind of community where we were studying a lot of theology, and we were really kind of coming into it at that point. I was really, you know, and I think everybody probably goes through a season where there's this really kind of intensive study where you just kind of, your mind is kind of opened up to it, and all of a sudden you feel like you can fit stuff in there you just couldn't fit in there before, and and you're just kind of interested in it in a way you hadn't been before, and you just can't get enough of it. And those were, there were a couple of years like that for me, you know, and those were kind of those Cademan's years, and that was really my instinct when I approached songwriting. Because the study of theology was such a huge part of my life at that point in that season, and so when I sat to write a song, my instinct was to try to put a theological language on an idea, and to try to that was kind of the way I did it, and that was just my instinct, and so She Must Shall Go Free, you have to remember, was not as much of a solo record as it was just the next batch of songs that I had written that very easily could have been on a Cademan's record. And I wasn't thinking in terms of being a solo artist or having a solo identity at that point, carving out my own space at all.
So those songs were a lot of what you had written thinking that they would work their way onto Cademan?
But really they were just the next songs I had written.
Okay.
And the Cademan's kind of separation for me was very unexpected.
Okay.
So when I wrote Wedding Dress, my instinct was that it would be on a Cademan's record. When I wrote, you know, all of those songs, I was thinking, at least as I was writing them, because where else would those songs go?
Sure.
You know, they're Cademan songs. They're not my solo songs. What does that even mean? I'm not a solo artist. And it wasn't until I felt Cademan's defending their calling, which was right of them to do, against some of these new songs I was writing, feeling that I was kind of taking things in a different direction, and that was us kind of sorting out, okay, well, they need to do their work and I might need to do mine, and maybe this is a little bit of being called out of one thing into another, and there's a moment where that happens, and there's a rightness about it, and it was right for Cademan's to kind of defend their calling. I mean, there's nothing weird about that still with us,
sure,
and they wanted me to go and do it. They just had a feeling, and I guess so did I, that Cademan's wasn't the place for me to sing these new songs. But you know, that first record was more of kind of a country folk rock record, and which was very much the style that I was writing still with Cademan's at that point. You know, Long Line of Leavers doesn't come off that way, but a lot of the songs I had written were kind of these little country songs. But a few of them got changed up because it pulled the band in too much of a style that the band didn't want to take on altogether at that point. So, you know, the song Dance, when I originally wrote it, which was on Long Line of Leavers, was a little kind of country song, very much like Love is Different, which is also on that record. They were really similar songs, but we didn't want all my songs on that record to be that style, so we kind of changed Dance up, and it became this other kind of terrible, awful thing that that ended up on the album. And then I later, you know, started playing it the way I'd written it, which I thought was much better, suited the song better. But if you look at the style of some of that, and then you look at She Must Shall Go Free, it's very much in the style of the last stuff I was writing for Cademan's. And the approach that I took when last I was writing for Cademan's. So it wasn't until... So I kind of look at She Must Shall Go Free as a transition record. And it could have just as easily been part of a Cademan's record if Cademan's had felt the same compulsion towards those issues that I had, which they didn't, which was fine. So then I see Things Upside Down, the second record, which no one ever talks about, but it's there, and it did come out. That record, I felt like was my kind of dismantling. It was a very experimental record, which I kind of took that opportunity, my friends and I intentionally took that opportunity to kind of dismantle everyone's kind of ideas of, about who I was an artist, what they could expect from me. There was a hymn on there, but there was also some a lot of other, there was like Ballad in Plain Red, which is this really random kind of very almost in character kind of sarcastic. I mean, it, we really tried to do a little bit of everything on that record and leave people at the end of that thinking, okay, now we don't have any idea what's coming next and we don't know what we can expect. So I kind of always thought of Mockingbird then as my first real solo record. Like, this is the first moment that I feel like I have a totally clean slate. I can make any kind of style. I can write in any kind of voice. This is my first moment that I can really do something uniquely me. And this is the and it was over those years between that first and third record that I really started to feel the compulsion towards these social issues. I started to see, while theology was still very important to me, I kind of started to feel like the season of that very intense theological study to kind of not come to a close, but to kind of calm a little bit. And I, that season kind of came to a rest. And I started to feel like, okay, now I need to put what I know of God's character and my condition, what I would call, what I would consider my theological kind of study, I need to put that to use now. I need to use that as now the grid through which I look at the world and stop just looking at the theological study as the end goal and now look at my entire kind of how I think Christianly about everything. I need to kind of put all that knowledge to use now. And so I started to look at the world, and during that time, you know, spending some time with friends who had been in it longer than I had, guys like Jars, who had since founded the Bloodwater Mission, and you know, kind of putting their theological knowledge to use, the gospel neighboring, as some, as Tim Keller I think has called it, you know, learning how to, you know, learning what the natural implications of gospel belief are. Like, if I believe there's a day coming when all things will be made right, how do I proclaim that to people? Part of the ways I one of the ways I proclaim it is to put my hands to it, is to pray that day into today, that day would start, would be inaugurated, and that work would be started with me and my hands today. You know, that when Jesus says that it's the implications of a person compelled to following him and compelled to him in Matthew 25, to put clothes on the naked and to comfort, you know, those who are, to visit those who are in prison and to feed the hungry and to, you know, you know, that this is, these are the natural implications of a changed heart that follows Jesus. This is what it looks like to follow Jesus. This is what it looks like to be in the Jesus business, as before we were talking about what is the Jesus business. This is what it looks like, as Jesus would tell us. And so as I started to grapple with that, and also looking around at that point, and that was just after the 2004 election, and to see kind of the church rear its ugly head into the political kind of realm, and as I said before, kind of started to come to grips with some of my role being an agitator and saying, what are the issues that are happening in the church that no one seems to be going after? And I thought, well, this needs talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not right. Mm-hmm. The way that the church is engaging politically, in my opinion, is not right. I think it's inappropriate. And somebody needs to bring it up. Mm-hmm. I just think somebody needs to get a more nuanced political conversation going. Mm-hmm. And somebody needs to at least challenge the political status quo of the Christian subculture in America right now, because it's really kind of going unchecked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what aspects of that, when you talk about political engagement, it seems like there's 1,000 different brands. What are the disturbing parts to you?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, just like
specific candidate stuff.
I remember some of it. Yeah. I mean, just the way that the church tries to oversimplify the issues.
Okay.
And doesn't spiritualize all of the social issues that are being dealt with in any one candidate's campaign. Like we seem to say there are only a couple of issues that really connect with our Christianity.
Yeah.
The other issues just don't. And that's just not true. You know, if you're going to use Christianity as a grid by which you look at the world,
yeah,
you suddenly find that all things have spiritual content and weight,
mm-hmm,
and that there, you know, that the weight of glory is kind of all around us, and that we, you know, everything from the condition of our environment,
mm-hmm,
to the condition of the living situation of the poorest of our neighbors, to,
mm-hmm,
I mean, there's just, it's everywhere, it's all around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just these few explicit spiritual issues or whatever.
Yeah.
The issues that seem to touch our morality the deepest. But those are important issues, they are. And,
mm-hmm,
and so, but we have to put those in with everything else, and we have to look at all of it, and maybe even transcend the political grid a little bit,
mm-hmm,
and not feel like we have to, as Christians, fit into the political grid and fit Jesus into a particular party,
mm-hmm,
compromising him completely to get him there.
Sure.
Because even though, like, the more conservative party might be closer on kind of the surface,
mm-hmm,
he still doesn't fit there.
Yeah.
He doesn't. And neither do we, therefore, mm-hmm, if we are little versions of him, if we are his little ambassadors into the world,
mm-hmm,
we shouldn't fit there any easier than he does, and he doesn't. And that's what bothered me, is that it seemed to be so easy for us just to walk a certain line,
mm-hmm,
and to just say, well, but this party just clearly represents our interests. Well, no, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Do they get a few things right? I think they do, probably, yeah. I mean, on the big issues that the church seems to champion. But what about all the rest? And what about even on those issues? They're not totally right.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I don't think it's the church's job to give over to the government the authority to legislate certain issues of morality. I don't think it's the church's job to tell the government that it can go and tell people what the definition of marriage is and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The church just oversimplifies it. And it really bothered me. And even driving down the street and seeing a Christian bookstore with a sign vilifying John Kerry, as I remember,
mm,
specifically calling him out by name.
Oh,
and I'm,
yeah,
thinking, what are we doing?
Yeah.
How is the church endorsing candidates?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, it just doesn't... I don't get how we can, in clear conscience, do this. Because there is no, as I addressed on my last record, there is no man that the church can endorse that in the White House will solve all of our problems.
Yeah.
The church's problems will not be solved by the right man in the White House,
mm-hmm,
and the church is oversimplifying it for her people by trying to convince them that's a possibility, that's a scenario that we could get ourselves into, giving the church too much false hope in that one man getting in there. We've had,
mm-hmm,
a man who I do believe is a Christian in the White House for the last 8 years, and I don't believe that any of the major issues that concern me have really been addressed or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I feel like some of the major issues that I'm concerned about have just been really exacerbated,
mm-hmm,
by his presence there. And I think it's been really difficult. I don't understand how a believer could navigate the political waters of the White House, if for no other reason, because I think it's a position of power.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus never sought positions of power. And he didn't seek power as a means by which to do the work that he had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Christians should either. I don't think power is the thing, although it's compelling, to say, well, here's, look at all this power. It's like Gandalf not wanting to touch the ring. I mean, through me, it could,
yeah,
wield such terrible and great power that I don't even need to go near it, although I would seek to use it for good.
Sure.
I think the same is true of the White House for a Christian. I think it's too terrible of a power to even go near it. And I,
mm-hmm,
really think that the Christian's work is the more humble and quiet and local work of Jesus and of Mother Teresa and of many and of Martin Luther King and of people who organize on the grassroots level and just love people one neighbor at a time,
mm-hmm,
and concern themselves with loving people on that level. I think that is much more tremendous and impacting and long-lasting work than one man with tremendous, with one,
mm-hmm,
one Christian with a ring on up on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And so, but the story is told to us in our culture that it's not that complicated and it's not that nuanced. That it's very much, it's really very simple. Find these two issues, find who has our agreeing positions on those issues, and go vote for that man and support that man and vilify everybody else. That is not the job of the church, and that frustrates me. Mm-hmm. Therefore, here comes Mockingbird.
Yeah.
And for me, it wasn't as much, I want you to agree with me on these issues, and I feel like these are the right positions on these issues. It's more just, we have got to, as Christians, start to think more critically about these issues. Now, I will lay out some of my feelings on these things, but more than anything, I just want to agitate you into maybe even disagreeing with me, but getting the conversation started. Mm-hmm. And that was really my role, I think, in that. And continuing on to Ringing Bell, maybe even more so specifically with a few of the issues.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like, I don't see this as, I don't see this as my disengaging and engaging elsewhere as far as topics.
Yeah.
I really do see this as, if I do believe, if I really believe that there's one who has shown up on the scene, who's kept the law on my behalf, and that it changes my life and it makes me look at the world in a new way, and it reveals to me a kingdom and a day coming where these things will all be made right, and that's the good news I have to proclaim to people and the work I have set before me to do with my hands, how do I then engage my world with that reality and with that good news? Mm-hmm. And to me, it looks, with my story, my particular gifts, and it's different for everybody, it looks like engaging into some of these issues in a social way and sometimes in a political way, in order to kind of bring about some of that change. Now, so for some other people, the reality of Christ and his life, death, resurrection, and his kingdom coming has them engaging in different ways in bringing that day, in longing for that day to come. And so I go in through a window and you go in through a door, but we're all building the same kingdom. We're all ultimately doing the same kingdom work. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it as a shift in focus. I don't see it as my no longer singing songs about the gospel. For one thing, I'm still singing those old songs. I still did put out those records.
Yeah.
And you can't put the burden on a Christian artist of having to restate their entire intention and agenda with every single record. I am telling one long story. She Must Shall Go Free is the first chapter. Yeah. Mockingbird is the third. Ringing Bell is the fourth.
Sure.
There's more chapters still coming. But I'm telling one long story. And so there's still the gospel context of the reason that I would ever be saying anything political or social, and that is because I do believe the things that I believe, and it compels me to live. You know, how should I live in light of what I believe to be true? Mm-hmm. I think it's reflected in these later records. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a culture that has a very short attention span, and people only will listen to one song or one record, but there's never a context around anything.
Yeah.
You have to look at the context around the work I'm doing to understand, like you said, the gospel intention of these later records. Mm-hmm. Because it bothers me for people to think that I no longer have a concern for the gospel. If I didn't have a concern for the gospel, why would I be staking my career and reputation on saying things that I believe are implications of the gospel that I believe on the world in which I live?
Yeah.
I would have no other reason to do it. Mm. And so, you know, so I think the context, that's why I would take you through the whole timeline.
Sure.
Because I think the context is very important in seeing how I've gotten to the point where I am and why in the world I'm doing what I'm doing now, you know.
Yeah, that's tremendous. Thanks.
Yeah.
The question I really want to get to here is with influences. I know everybody's influenced by a lot of different
everything,
people.
Yeah.
Right now, with some of this transition we've talked about, where you're moving from what you see as the gospel to more implications of the gospel, kind of in an American society or whatever. Who's been influential for you? Who's been helpful to you, either musically or authors or?
I mean, all kinds of stuff. I'm not a good enough writer to be able to sit and intentionally write anything. It kind of happens to me, and so everything that goes in kind of comes out, because I really just write what's right before me. It's pure instinct for me, so I can't write myself out of it, I guess is what I'm saying. So whatever I'm interested in, whatever I'm listening to, whenever I'm reading, it's just going to show up all over whatever I'm writing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's whatever goes in just gets shifted, kind of sifted, and then it comes out. But as far as, it's interesting, like in my more Reformed tradition, when I was looking for people I could read to prepare for some of these records in terms of, you know, people who have focused on the more social aspects of the gospel, and of course I don't mean the social gospel. I don't mean giving up one for the other any more than I mean following Jesus so closely that you don't care for your neighbors and that you don't care for. I mean, I think the social gospel is, in as far as what we know of it in our history and, mm-hmm. and the euphemism that that's become,
sure.
That I would have nothing to do with, of course. I think there's just as much a danger on the other side, mm-hmm. Of there being no social implication, no neighboring implication to mm-hmm. what we believe about Jesus, which is where I lived for a long time too.
Mm-hmm.
That I was so concerned with my right theology that it actually kept me from loving my neighbors well. In mm-hmm. fact, it had me loving them really poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you can err on both sides. So I think we do need to be careful the whole social gospel thing, but no one's being careful on the other side. Mm-hmm. No one's saying you're becoming obsessive with theology and it's keeping you from loving your neighbors in the way you've been commanded to do. It's the second greatest command behind mm-hmm. love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. I mean, you're so obsessed with the law. The law is pretty simple. I mean, like what Jesus would have us doing is pretty simple. Love God and love your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Is your theology helping you or hurting you from doing that? And I think that's a question not enough people are asking, mm. especially in the academic world. And yet we're so quick to criticize anyone who would even come close to looking like they're erring on the other side of the of loving our neighbors so much that our theology has taken a back seat. I would hope to err on neither side.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, as I started to look at more Reformed writers mm-hmm. to get some sort of a trajectory for this when I was writing these other records, I didn't really come up with much. There's not a lot of Reformed guys who've written very much on it.
Mm-hmm.
Keller had his book about Mercy Ministries that he mm-hmm. wrote that was really good, and I checked that out. And that was kind of all that I found. Mm-hmm. I ended up having to kind of go outside of my tradition to some other traditions, which and I found some tremendous. I mean, we can disagree on certain aspects of soteriology. We can disagree on certain aspects of end times or anything else, I don't have to have the same theology as in some of these niches mm-hmm. in order to really draw a lot of tremendous insight, biblical insight from people outside of my tradition when it comes to some of these other things. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself a lot in the Methodist tradition in terms of their views of justice and, mm-hmm. and even the peace tradition with some of those kind of churches, Mennonite mm-hmm. writers and some Episcopal, writers and just some other traditions, even Roman Catholic, brothers and sisters who have done some really consistent, tremendous work in terms of having a consistent ethic of human life in terms mm-hmm. of, taking as seriously, the destruction of any human life, mm-hmm. not just abortion, where the Protestant Church really champions, but also war and death penalty, and just really trying to examine all of it and say, we need to be concerned with all of it, And
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of great resources out there, and so I looked at a lot of that stuff. Stan Harawas is a friend who is up at Duke Divinity, who is kind of, he is like the tip of the arrow in terms of kind of the tradition of nonviolent engagement, and John Yoder before him.
Mm-hmm.
I was really influenced by a lot of Harawas's writings, and there's a ton of guys who a tremendous amount of great books that I read. Greg Boyd mm-hmm. wrote a book called The Myth of a Christian Nation, which is tremendous. Jim Wallace is a friend of mine. He's in Washington, and he wrote God's Politics, which mm-hmm. was a
sure.
which was a great book, I thought, in terms of having a more nuanced conversation about politics. I really enjoyed his book, and I've really enjoyed Jim over the years. And I think there's a lot of issues that Jim and I can unify over, and we don't agree on everything. But that's not a criteria for which I mm-hmm. work with people, because if I only worked with people based on that we have to agree on every point of theology, that I wouldn't really even be able to work with myself because I'm conflicted about certain things. You know what I'm saying? Like we can't say we're only going to work with people and like people and deal with people that we totally agree with, because that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the kingdom looks like. We're every tribe, tongue, and people group. I mean, we're coming from every different direction, so we got to learn how to compromise a little mm-hmm. bit, unify where we can, and work with one another.
Sure.
Break bread over what we can break bread over, and other things, I mean, the gospel alone we divide over. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what Paul would tell us. And, so anyways, a lot of those kind of folks, musically, Martin Luther King, is a huge, because he was a believer coming at a very social issue, working the political system but never really having an allegiance to it, he navigated those waters really well, really inspiring. And musically, the same old, the usual suspects. I mean, Bob Dylan, the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking earlier. We were like, you know, ringing bell, that kind of sounded like the Beatles a little bit.
Yeah,
know?
I mean, I'm just...
Have you heard that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I told people that before it came out. I was like, you know, I warned people that I'd listened to Revolver pretty much nonstop. And I literally sat there and A-B'd, you know, with the guitar sound from Taxman. Okay. You know, I mean, like, I love that the sound of those records. I mean, I love it. And it's like... I mean, I listen to some newer records, but not much. But my default is just to put those old Beatles records on, and especially the more experimental ones. And I just love that sound. I mean, those records, I never get tired of listening to those records. Some of that Beatles music from the late 60s, there are more experimental records, Magical Mystery Tour, you know, Peppers, Revolver, any of those records, you know, Yellow Submarine. That music still sounds like the future to me. That sounds like stuff that hasn't yet happened. It sounds like something somebody put in a spaceship and sent back in time to us or something. That music still sounds like it hasn't happened yet, you know. Yeah. And so I want to make stuff that avoids time stamps in the same way if I can.
That's good. Question on this is we've talked kingdom, church, kind of the question in my mind now is how do you see the church and then the kingdom of God, are these two synonymous in your mind? What is the relationship?
I mean, I don't know. It's really mysterious. It's a good question, and I wish my friend Brian Habig was here because he could certainly answer the question better than I could. But and a lot of my thoughts have come from reading, you know, him and a handful of other friends. I don't think they're the same thing, the kingdom and the church. You know, I think the easiest, one of the easiest places to see maybe the place where they're not. I think there is overlap. I think the kingdom is a broader idea to me than the church is. I think that there are certain things in our culture that are clearly church work. Mm-hmm. It's the work of the church to do certain things that I think Jesus has prescribed the church to do. And beyond that, the work of Christians is kingdom work. And for instance, I don't necessarily believe that it's the church's work to have a multi-million-dollar music concert venue in their building where they gather to have worship. I don't think that's church work.
Yeah.
I don't. Now, I do think that's kingdom work, though. I think if you have gifts and knowledge to put those kind of systems together, and you know how to do that, and I think that's absolutely kingdom work to do that. I don't think the church is the context where we should be doing it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need all of that in our churches. I think it just overcomplicates and it wastes tithing dollars to do things like that. But I think to have a great concert venue where people can come and enjoy music can absolutely be kingdom work, without a doubt. That's work Christians can do in the context of culture but the church has such specific things that we're supposed to be doing. That if we don't focus on, we can get distracted from, and we find ourselves doing a lot of other kind of work that just is not our job. I mean, and so I feel like that the church has certain work, and beyond that, it's kingdom work. But the church is such a specific institution, and then we go from the church out into the world, and we build the kingdom in every corner. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, it's. But that's probably the best place I can look at and say, here's the difference. Here's the place I can see the difference. But certainly I believe that they are in many ways connected. I mean, you know, and overlap in many ways. But, you know, I probably sound like a kindergartner talking to seminary students about things like this.
Oh, that's good.
You know?
That's good. I didn't understand. But when you were talking about music, I really just nodded my head on that stuff. So,
but that's my instinct, you know, which is just plagiarizing guys like Habeg, you know, who would draw that real distinction between kingdom work and church work. And that really helped me for a long time to say, you know, as a musician, my job is to write and to sing songs. That's my vocation. And Steve Turner also helped me to kind of form my thoughts on this, but that I'm not in full-time vocational ministry. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I don't consider myself a full-time vocational minister. I'm a singer-songwriter. Just like with any vocation, with any job, there are moments of ministry that happen. You look for them, and you hope that when those moments come that you can take full advantage of them. But my intention with my work is to do excellent work. Mm-hmm. You know, my brother's a doctor. He's not a full-time vocational minister, with his healthcare providing. He does it for money. He does it to provide excellent healthcare for people. Now, in the context of his job, there are moments where he can do ministry and he can talk to people about the truth and about the gospel, about the day coming where, you know, where our bodies won't be broken anymore and what a glorious day that is. And why that day is coming and how that brings us to the cross and how it's all, you know, centered on that moment. And, you know, yeah, he has that moments, but that's not his intention why he goes to work every day, to communicate that to people. He goes in order to do excellent work. And, you know, so I have a lot of ministry that I feel like I'm intentionally doing. It has very little to do with my job. It has more to do with what my wife and I do in our neighborhood, what we do through our church, what we do with organizations like Bloodwater Mission. Now, I'm not trying to over-categorize. I'm actually trying to under-categorize. I'm trying to say ministry is more pervasive. It's more subversive. It's more... It's not right on the surface. But whereas my job is something very clearly intentioned that I'm out doing. And I think that's maybe a good personal way of saying some of this is church work, some of this is kingdom work. And what I'm doing with my job is not, I don't think it's church work, I think it's kingdom work. It goes beyond that. It goes beyond the specific calling, what the church is to be doing in culture until Jesus returns.
Okay, that's great. What's I going to say next? Oh, labels. Labels. You get them all the time, I'm sure, right? Are you?
Sometimes.
Are you this? Are you that? Here's one. Do you consider yourself an evangelical? You've talked about your tradition. You're talking about yourself as kind of a reformed evangelical. Mm-hmm. Do you still kind of, are you comfortable with that label still?
Let me tell you the place where I am now.
Okay.
And I'll warn you to say that I'm in a place where I have no care for efficiency in answering questions.
That's all right, man.
I could care less about being able to give a really good, concise answer to a question, because I think everything matters in terms of communicating clearly, and I don't think always that the easiest way to do it is brief. I am a lot more concerned nowadays with being, with, if somebody asks me a question, if somebody comes up, and you're doing it right now, are you an evangelical? I would rather talk for 2 hours about what the definition of the word evangelical is than before I would ever agree to a label like that.
Yeah.
Because here's the problem, is that word means something different to 10 people. If you ask 10 people, you're going to get 10 different answers. What does the word evangelical mean? What is a Calvinist? What is Reformed? What is a Christian even in our country right now?
Yeah.
I would also pause and prefer a long conversation rather than to give a simple answer to the question, are you a Christian? Because I'm not going to answer that question, and the reason is because I have no idea what you're really asking
me.
And even after we have a long conversation, that doesn't mean the work's over, because then when somebody else walks up and asks the same question, we're starting from scratch. I learned this from Bob Dylan in the 60s when he would answer all these questions on his press. Somebody would ask him, are you a folk singer? He'd say, well, how am I supposed to answer that question? we have to define every what do you mean a singer? Like, what is folk music? Like, what are you trying to ask me? And he would take 2 hours to make them define every word in their question before he would even start to answer any of it. But he'd say, but you know, you can't print any of that, because my answer is only true for you. Because all your readers are going to have all their own definitions for all those words, so you can't even print any of this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I am really more concerned with being a clear communicator and representing clearly what I believe than to even go near any of those kind of words. So nowadays I don't want to go near words like Reformed or Evangelical or even Christian or Reformed. I don't like any of those words, because I don't think any of those things are going to really clearly communicate who I am or what I believe. And I'm really concerned with people understanding me. And I'm more concerned with individuals understanding me than a mass group of people understanding me. And I would rather be misunderstood by a group of people and understood by individuals. I think all this is a product of the world where we live. We live in a place where, you know, mass groups of people can get mass amounts of information in a split second. And regardless of whether my feelings on answering questions like this make me really complicated for the world we live in right now, it doesn't make any difference to me. I would rather, you know, make some people really mad and say, oh, well, that's stupid. You know, everybody knows what a Christian is. He should have answered that question. What are you, ashamed of the faith? I'd rather people be upset with me and have concerns like that, and to be able to one day sit down with them individually and talk through that, and for them to understand me, than to be than to for them to be satisfied and to be completely misunderstood by a host of people, none of whom I know, and have completely wrong ideas about what a Christian is, mm-hmm. and I've just agreed to them that that's what I am. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've said ridiculously before that what if aliens came down from another planet, and where they come from, the word Christian has nothing to do with Jesus or anything else. Mm-hmm. It's a name for a person who kills and eats babies. I don't know, something terrible and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And they come down and they walk right up to me and say, "Are you a Christian?" And I just, without qualification, say, "Yeah, of course I'm a Christian." Mm-hmm. And they say, "Okay," and they think I'm a person who kills and eats babies. I mean, am I satisfied? Have I stood up for the faith and been strong? No, I've actually done a really terrible disservice to my Savior, who I claim to follow, mm-hmm. by agreeing to some label that he wouldn't have agreed to. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people in our country who have a strange equivalent to people who kill and eat babies to the word Christian.
Sure.
And I absolutely refuse to be a part of that. I want to be really clear. And I have a lot of people who I love and care about, who I care more about than I care about people who want to hear a really easy answer out of me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that heads off any of your other questions.
that saved us an hour. No,
yeah,
no, that was the. I'm thinking this more from the emerging church. What was the guy? The post evangelical post Southern.
You probably talk about Brian McLaren.
Yeah, Brian McLaren. I mean, that was his whole deal. He's like, I'm post. You know, you can't label me, right? But then at the end of the day, we label him anyway. We label him confusing. You know, mm-hmm. So
and he's probably satisfied to have that label on himself.
Yeah,
he's probably satisfied to say, you know what? If you want to call me a, you don't know if I'm an evangelical, you don't know if I'm a this, you don't know if I'm that. I mean, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And I would rather be in a place where I'm in a better, and I'm speaking on Brian's behalf, which I have no right to do. I know Brian, but he'd probably say himself, I'd rather be in a position where I'm maybe in a better position than those people who love those labels to go and engage with sure. some of these people who won't go near those evangelical fundamental people, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he is in a better position to go and speak into some of those communities. Mm-hmm. And I would rather be that kind of person. I mean, I think Jesus himself was always gave an answer we were never expecting, mm-hmm. and even confounded his closest followers. He never took those kind of labels on himself. Mm-hmm. And he was careful to keep himself at all times in a position to best love the people around him. And if taking a label on myself that would make someone, before I even approach them, think that I hate them mm-hmm. and I judge them, is not me keeping myself in the best posture to love them. And that is a great concern of mine, more of a concern than being a person who's easily understood, mm-hmm. Or not criticized by other people in the community of mm-hmm. faith who think it's ridiculous to not go ahead and take that label on yourself.
Sure.
I could just absolutely care less. There are people in my neighborhood who I know have been, who struggle with certain things, and because of those struggles have been really harshly judged and alienated by the people who go by the names that I would now seek to stay out from under. Mm-hmm. And I would rather keep myself in a position to live with and love those people than to feel like I have to represent something, yeah. some set of beliefs or some set of propositions that I would have to go to them and have to overcome that before they would even listen to me trying to love them and live with them. So I've got bigger concerns than labels mm-hmm. at this point in my life.
If you could write the definition Christian, how would you write it?
I mean, very simply, I would say someone who follows Jesus.
Someone who follows Jesus.
Because, I mean, wherever Jesus goes, I hope to follow. Even if he leads me out of the institution, even if he leads me away from, you know, the collected subculture of his people, and certain moments, I would hope that I would be brave enough to follow him there. You know, so that's really as far as I can say. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, someone who follows after Jesus is, I mean, you know.
Based on that definition, would you venture a guess on how much of what we call Christian, just in the generic mm-hmm. sense, is really Christian?
I really can't. I don't have any idea. I mean, I think there are people well-intentioned who follow him up to a certain point, who are following certain things that he said and not others, and I don't think that I'm any better. I don't think that I'm following him completely or rightly. I don't. Mm-hmm. Not for a second. But that's like a thorn in my side that brings me continually back to his feet. I mean, that's the whole point of being a follower of Jesus, that I would see myself as a total utter failure at it. I'm a terrible Christian. I always will be, and that's the whole point. And that's what continually brings me back to my need for a Savior. And that's why every day I come to him again, and I come to him again, And he has to save me again every day. I mean, that's why the gospel is just as relevant to me now as it was when I was after a sophomore in high school, you know, coming to him for the first time. I mean, you know, I don't claim to follow him rightly. But I think there are a lot of people who maybe focus in to certain things mm-hmm. that he said. I mean, I think if we were to sit and talk clearly and think clearly for just a moment, I think we could probably agree that the people who what we would call fundamentalists, people who really take the law. Now, here's my definition, though. The definition of a fundamentalist, which is different than everyone else's. But my life experience, my particular story, has led me to sit here and tell you that I believe, and I don't really believe this, but I'm telling you because it's what I'm saying, that a fundamentalist is a person who, or at least the way most people see the word fundamentalist, who takes the law, who takes the teachings of Jesus, and uses it very much like the Pharisees did as a club to beat with the law, to beat people with it, to beat people into submission, or to beat people into a knowledge of their need for Jesus. Mm-hmm. Kirk Cameron and that other guy he's on TV with all the time who go into the public square and literally beat people with the law and humiliate people publicly with the law to bring them to a knowledge of their need for Jesus, which I do not believe is biblical. I don't believe you see a precedent of Jesus using the law to beat people and to humiliate people, not the sick anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I think if we were to be frank about it, I think most people would agree that do I think the law has a place in the life of a Christian? Absolutely. Do I think that the law is a great tutor to bring us to our need for Jesus? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But yet, does that bring me to a place where I believe that this is the right application of it, to take it as a club and to beat people spiritually and emotionally mm-hmm. and humiliate them to the point where they just have nowhere to go but Jesus? No. So do I believe that those people are rightfully following Jesus? I think they think that they do. Mm-hmm. Just like I probably think that I'm rightfully following and I'm not. Mm-hmm. Which is the very thing that Jesus ultimately saves me from, is my thinking that I'm living rightly and that I'm following him rightly is ultimately the thing that he saves me from. My crazy ideas of what it is to be a Christian and who I even believe he is, I mean, to some extent, are all the things, it's all wrapped up mm-hmm. in the thing that he saves me from, which is ultimately what brings me to my Reformed view of salvation, is that it was done to me. It wasn't my earnestness. It wasn't the fact that I prayed the prayer correctly. I believe it was done to me. And I don't even believe that it's my rightness, even in the moment of my praying that prayer or having a clear thought about Jesus. I don't think it's ever that I understood him rightly that brought me to him. I think it's him, he himself, that brought me to him. And that I might never think rightly of him. And that doesn't put my salvation at any moment in peril. Because I can no more undo it than I can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's what ultimately brings me back to my Reformed view of salvation. But either way, what I was saying is I think we can agree that people who use the law to beat people and humiliate people, I think we could probably say they think that they are following Jesus rightly, but I think we could probably, at least in this room, agree that they're probably not.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean their salvation's in peril either. They're just the same as I am.
Yeah.
It's just a different brand of it. But so that's kind of what I'm getting at, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of some of these labels. And
yeah, well, that's great. Derek, thanks again for taking the time to meet with us. And that concluded our interview with Derek Webb. Thanks again for downloading this podcast. You can find more great interviews in the future at setitsouthern.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast now through iTunes. And this has been Tony Coomer, and thanks for listening.
They'll know us by the t-shirts that we wear, and they'll know us by the way we point and stare at anyone whose sin looks worse than ours, who cannot hide the scars of this curse that we all bear, and they'll know us by our picket line.